2016, many states continue to routinely treat juveniles as adults. Each year, an estimated 250,000 U.S. juveniles are transferred into adult courts. In California, 3/4 of those juveniles are transferred by prosecutors using the discretion given to them by Proposition 21. This discretion has not been evenly applied. A 2012 analysis by California's Department of Justice found that cases against black youths were more than twice as likely to be directly filed in adult court than cases against white youths, and cases against Latino youths were more than 6 times as likely. And the disparity didn't end there. Once they landed in adult court, young black and brown offenders were also much more likely to serve time. Just 1/3 of white youths were sentenced to adult or juvenile state correctional facilities in 2012, while 2/3 were given probation or sentenced to serve time in county jails. For kids of color, the ratios were reversed. 2/3 served time in state facilities, while 1/3 received probation or jail. Nationally, 58% of all incarcerated African American youths are serving their time in adult prisons. "What he did was a terrible thing," Jasmine said after Richard was charged. "I'm not trying to defend his actions because it was very terrible." Even so, she said, Richard was a kid who was capable of making an exceedingly dumb mistake, but one who was also capable of learning from it. "Life in jail? A 16-year-old? It's ridiculous," she said. "They need to give him time to grow. Why lock him up and have him institutionalized and make him worse?" Court date. On November 7th, the day Richard made his first court appearance, reporters packed the hallways. "What kind of boy is he?" one shouted, as Jasmine and her sister Juliet stepped into the elevator with Richard's grandmother. "He's a good kid, a very good kid," the grandmother, also named Juliet, said. "Why do you think he did this?" another reporter asked. "I don't know. He was with his friends joking around, that's all," she said. "He's not a bad person. If you knew him, you'd know he's always joking around," Richard's Aunt Juliet said in a separate interview. "He shouldn't have did what he did. I feel so bad." Jasmine spoke to the press, too, off camera. "I am very sorry for my son's actions," she said. "I did not raise my son that way." That's what they said. But all anyone seemed to hear was this: he was joking around. "Setting someone on fire because of their clothes is not a joke or prank gone awry," editorialized the Bay Area Reporter, a newspaper serving the LGBTQ community. As Alameda County prosecutors correctly see it, it's a felony. And Richard surely isn't laughing at the possibility of life in prison because he apparently couldn't handle someone dressing differently. Online forums seethed with outrage. To the mother of the 16-year-old who set the fire, "You call that just joking around? Suppose some kid set you on fire, burned, say, 90% of your body. Would that be joking around? Your son needs life in prison for attempted murder," a man named Brian Weil wrote on an anti-bullying Facebook page. The comment received 160 likes. On news sites, blogs, and forums around the country, the conclusion was the same. Lock him up, throw away the key. Lock up the mother, too, while you're at it. Many suggested far worse. Reeling. Jasmine felt the world had spun off its axis. It was impossible, and yet it was true. Richard had hurt someone, really hurt them, somebody who hadn't done anything to anyone. She was mad at Richard. She was mad at Lloyd. She was mad at herself. She was mad at society. How could this have happened? She knew what people were saying about Richard, about her. She'd seen the online comments. Her sister Juliet advised her not to tell anyone about Richard's arrest, but she wasn't going to hide. "If you have anything to say, bad comments, take it to God," she told everyone who asked about Richard. "Pray for him." The desk. Nancy O'Malley, the Alameda County District Attorney, worked at a weighty, dark wood desk that was once used by Earl Warren, the U.S. Supreme Court Justice, whose court ruled that public school segregation was unconstitutional in the landmark 1954 decision Brown v. Board of Education. A round-faced blonde with a brisk, no-nonsense manner, she was known as a crusader for the rights of women and children. Her prosecutorial priorities included sex trafficking, domestic violence, and child abuse. She had a reputation as tough but generally fair. Her office had one of the lowest direct file rates in the state. But in this particular case, O'Malley had no qualms about prosecuting Richard as an adult. "The crime is very, very, very serious," she explained. "But for some good Samaritans, Sasha could very well be dead. He lit Sasha's skirt on fire on the bus in the middle of the day, and that's very, very disturbing behavior. If the defendant doesn't change and get rehabilitated, he's a very serious person in our society and a real threat to anyone." A threat, she argued, because hate crimes are discrimination, just as segregation was. And as the occupant of Earl Warren's desk, she was determined to fight discrimination wherever she found it. "We have a history, a long history in this country of people and cultures who have been treated badly because of their race, their gender, their religion, and all the protected classes that we've identified under the law," she explained. "So if somebody commits a heinous crime against somebody because they are a member of a protected class, that is very purposeful discrimination. It's important to show that this is the kind of behavior that will never be tolerated." Until the mid-1980s, the law made no distinction between crimes motivated by bigotry and crimes motivated by money, passion, or boredom. Murder was murder, vandalism was vandalism. The term hate crime was coined in response to what was described at the time as an epidemic of neo-Nazi and skinhead violence, although in retrospect, it's unclear whether any such epidemic existed. Since then, the number of bias-motivated prosecutions has steadily gone down. In California, a state with close to 39 million people, hate crime prosecutions have fallen 48% since 2003, with just 158 bias crimes filed for prosecution in 2012. Since bias crimes are vastly underreported, however, the true number is undoubtedly higher than the statistics indicate. But despite how infrequently they're prosecuted, high-profile hate crimes offer a powerful narrative, one that has been important in fighting prejudice. A hate crime is bias boiled down to its most vile essence. Even someone who isn't sure what they think about hiring people who are black, gay, or transgender can feel the essential wrongness of hurting someone because they are black, gay, or transgender. By revealing the raw ugliness at the heart of prejudice, high-profile hate crime prosecutions have helped build empathy for people on the margins. Perhaps the most high-profile hate crime prosecutions in Alameda County history were against four men who murdered a transgender teenager named Gwen Araujo in 2002 after discovering her biological sex. In the wake of that case, California's state legislature passed the Gwen Araujo Justice for Victims Act, which allows juries to be instructed before they begin deliberations that they should not allow themselves to be influenced by bias against the gender identity of the victim, defendant, or witnesses. Yet the majority of hate crime offenders don't fit the stereotype of the squinting, bristle-headed loner with a swastika tattoo or a Confederate flag T-shirt. Researchers estimate that fewer than 5% are members of an organized hate group. Most are young males, either in their teens or early 20s, acting in a group, often immediately after school. In a study of Boston hate crime prosecutions in the early 1900s, two-thirds of the offenders were categorized as thrill-seeking. That is, they were groups of young people looking for some fun at the expense of someone they regarded as lower status. The authors of the study found that many of these offenders weren't even particularly biased toward their victims, but were following the lead of a more biased peer. Many hate crimes, according to Phyllis B. Gerstenfeld, a criminal justice professor at California State University Stanislaus, don't have as much to do with the victim as they do with the offender and their own insecurity, which, of course, is a lot of what's going on with adolescents in general. Maybe that's why Nancy O'Malley received a surprising letter in November 2013. The letter was from two groups that might have been expected to support O'Malley's decision to charge Richard as an adult: the National Center for Lesbian Rights and the Transgender Law Center. When juvenile impulsivity and poor judgment produce dire consequences, it does not make sense to craft a response intended for adults, they said in a letter that was also sent on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union of Northern California. Rather, these are the very circumstances under which it is important to remember that children are different from adults. The letter concluded, "We firmly believe that you can demonstrate your office's commitment to protecting the victims of hate crimes without imposing adult sanctions on juvenile offenders." Under the influence of adolescence. When people say children are different from adults, what do they mean? Is a 16-year-old really a child? By that age, surely any rational person knows not to go around setting people's clothing on fire. That, anyway, was the argument made by many online commentators. He's 16, not 10. If he doesn't know by now that trying to kill other people is bad, then it's a bit too late for him. Some people cannot be fixed. If he behave like an animal, then he should be treated like one, one wrote. If you have to be taught why and you're 16, then you're never going to be anything but a threat or a curse to everyone around you, wrote another. It's true that in terms of pure intellect, teenagers are just as smart as adults, just as able to reason, and just as knowledgeable about the consequences of risky behavior. But they are also wired differently. Many people have observed that adolescents tend to be more reckless, impulsive, and vulnerable to peer pressure than adults. It turns out that at least part of the explanation for this behavior can be found in the structure of the teenage brain. The limbic system is the part of the brain that detects things in the environment that we should pay attention to and sends an emotional signal about what to do in response. Avoid, investigate, eat, fight, flirt. Starting around puberty, the limbic system becomes more sensitive to stimulus, which is one reason teenagers become both more emotional and more interested in having new and intense experiences. Throughout adolescence, the brain is busily lining important neural pathways with a fatty sheath called myelin. Myelin is often likened to the plastic coating around electrical wires. It insulates the neural circuits, making them about 100 times faster than unmyelinated circuits. The very last part of the brain to get myelinated is the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain responsible for reason, planning, and deliberation. So while teenage emotions have gone into hyperdrive, reason and logic are still obeying the speed limit. The result is that while teenagers can make decisions that are just as mature, reasoned, and rational as adults' decisions in normal circumstances, their judgment can be fairly awful when they are feeling intense emotions or stress, conditions that psychologists call hot cognition. In those situations, teens are more likely to make decisions with the limbic system rather than the prefrontal cortex. The presence of peers is one of the things that raises the emotional stakes, making it more likely that teens will seek out risk and short-term reward without pausing to consider the consequences. Even the brightest, best-meaning teenager doesn't tend to think much beyond the moment, especially when they're with their friends, observes Gerstenfeld. As people grow up, they generally get better at making thoughtful decisions even when under pressure. Studies have found that around the world, antisocial behavior increases by a factor of 10 during adolescence and then begins to taper off as people reach their early 20s. Criminologists call this the age crime curve. But it doesn't always. Some people start committing crimes when they're young and keep on committing them, progressing from burglary to robbery to murder. The problem is, there's no way to know which kid is going to mellow with age and which one is just getting warmed up. You cannot tell when you're looking at a 16-year-old whether they are irredeemably depraved, explains Barry Feld, a law professor at the University of Minnesota, who is one of the nation's foremost experts on juvenile justice. So how should we look at teenagers who commit bias crimes? Are they kids with deep-seated character flaws who are likely to be antisocial bigots for the rest of their lives? Or are they simply manifesting the worst aspects of adolescence? An obsession with conformity, group identity, and peer approval, combined with an appetite for risk and sensation? Or are they at a fork in the road, a place where their future will be determined by what happens next? The proponents of hate crime laws are liberals, and yet they are the ones who are the biggest critics of mass incarceration, observes James B. Jacobs, director of New York University's Center for Research in Crime and Justice, and an expert on hate crime laws. So there are ironies piled on ironies. The remedy here is imprisonment, and prisons are the ultimate incubators of antisocial attitudes. Life at Bothan. The first surgery was soon followed by a second. Dr. Grossman needed to cut away more dead tissue. He felt that the wounds still weren't clean enough for a skin graft. After that, things settled into a routine. By the end of the first week of Sasha's hospitalization, Debbie and Carl had returned to work part-time, arriving at the hospital every afternoon around 2 p.m. and staying into the evening. Sasha didn't have the concentration to read or watch movies, so they spent their time dozing, scrolling idly through Tumblr, and calculating how long it would be until they got another dose of painkillers. "What makes you get out of bed in the morning?" a friend asked Sasha on Tumblr, as part of a list of get-to-know-you questions that got passed from person to person. "It used to be not wanting to miss the bus and be late to school," Sasha wrote. "Now it's my nurses taking me to the tub." Being bathed in the huge stainless steel tub was Sasha's favorite part of the day. The official name for it was hydrotherapy. The purpose was to keep the wounds clean and prevent infection. All Sasha knew was that the water and towels were warm. It was pleasant floating there, a welcome change from lying in bed waiting for the next dose of Dilaudid. Friends came to visit, dressed in yellow paper gowns, their hands covered by blue synthetic rubber gloves, and their faces hidden behind paper masks. Two visitors were allowed in at a time. Nemo and Michael were the first to come. Healy visited a few days later with Taya. Sasha had asked them not to bring food because everyone had been bringing food. They brought food anyway. Vegan sushi from Berkeley. It was nice to have visitors, but Sasha wanted to go home. It was hard to sleep at the hospital. The room was always too hot or too cold, and it was often permeated with odd noises. For a while, Sasha's roommate was a man in a medically induced coma who was hooked up to a breathing machine that hissed and thumped in a rhythmic pattern. Their next roommate had burns over half his body. He'd gotten them in a house fire after running back to save his dog. He was friendly and chatty at first, more chatty than Sasha was in the mood for, actually. Then his burns became infected, and he grew quieter. At night, he moaned and murmured in his sleep. not visiting. Andrew didn't visit. He planned to, but when the day arrived, there was always a reason not to go. I could have done it if I just set aside my bullshit feelings and been there for them, he said. The bullshit feelings had to do with a worry that he hadn't been as good a friend to Sasha as Sasha had been to him. That year, he'd had his first real boyfriend. The relationship was all-consuming in a not entirely healthy way, and Sasha had felt like a third wheel whenever they were together. And, of course, Andrew and Sasha went to different schools and had different friends, and it was totally normal to grow apart. Except that Sasha had once been the most important person in the world to Andrew, and he felt bad and weird about the fact that they weren't close anymore. Like, maybe it was his fault. And then he felt bad and weird about feeling bad and weird. So maybe it would be uncomfortable if he showed up at the hospital. But then Andrew would remember how Sasha had visited him when he was hospitalized for depression 2 years before, just after starting 9th grade. Sasha had come to the hospital on Andrew's 15th birthday, and they had brought a present, a gift card for an art supply store. It had been so good to see Sasha's face that day. Sasha had been so upbeat. Not in a cheery, let's put a good face on this way, but in a God, I'm so happy you're okay way. Now that the situation was reversed, the least he could do was return the favor. Just show up, for Christ's sake. He should go. He would go. He'd visit Sasha tomorrow. Next week at the latest. But he never did. I had no idea how to even go in the room, he said later, because Sasha would be there in a hospital bed, burned. And the thought of seeing that, of seeing what could happen to gender non-conforming people, made Andrew's palms grow slick with fear. I knew I wasn't in danger by being there, that's silly, he said. But it was just like, this is how it is for people like us. This is the reality. The first letter. November 8, 2013. Dear victim, I apologize for my actions, for the pain that I brought to you and your family. I was wrong for what I did. I was wrong. I had no reason to do that to you. I don't know what was going through my head at that time. I'm not a monster. I have a big heart. I never even thought of hurting anyone like the way I hurt you. I just wanted you to know that I'm deeply sorry for my actions. I think about what happened every second. I pray that you heal correctly and that you recover and live a happy life. Please forgive me. That's all I want. I take responsibility for all my actions. I'll take all the consequences. I wish you and your family the best of luck. I'm not just saying this because I'm incarcerated. I honestly mean every word. Love, Richard. Into the briefcase. Within days of his arrest, Richard's family scraped the money together to hire a private attorney to handle his defense. They chose Bill Dubois, a courtly 40-year veteran of the Alameda County Courthouse who had represented a number of high-profile defendants, including one of the men who murdered the transgender teenager Gwen Araujo in 2002. At their first meeting, Richard gave Dubois two letters he'd handwritten to Sasha, the one he wrote on November 8th, and a second he wrote on November 11th. Dubois took the letters and tucked them away in his briefcase. Because the letters contained an admission of guilt, he felt he couldn't send them until the case was resolved. It would be 14 months before Sasha read them. Skirts for Sasha. On Friday, November 8th, everyone at Maybeck wore a skirt. Teachers, students, staff, even Healy, who didn't own any skirts. She used a pinafore that she'd worn as a costume in a play. Ian dressed as much like Sasha as he could manage, in a skirt, knee socks, flat cap, and vest. Nemo wore a tartan skirt over jeans. Michael wore a black miniskirt, along with his signature khaki jacket and gray beanie. A photo of Maybeck students holding a sign saying "Skirts for Sasha" was taken by a photographer for the San Jose Mercury News and reposted to dozens of LGBTQ and anti-bullying blogs. A week later, under the light of a three-quarter moon, roughly 150 supporters, including students from both Maybeck and Oakland high schools, marched along the route of the 57 bus. The march started at the street corner where Richard and Lloyd had gotten on the bus the week before. Television cameras jockeyed for position, nearly knocking each other over in their eagerness to get the best shot. The kids from Maybeck peered curiously at Oakland High School. Most of them had never seen it before. For a minute, there was a lot of anger toward Oakland High School at Maybeck, Michael recalls. But they were really good at distancing themselves from the guy who lit Sasha on fire. Drums beat in the background, keeping time with the thwop-thwop-thwop of the news helicopters overhead as the marchers tied rainbow ribbons to the bus stop poles between Ojai and the spot where Sasha usually got off. People carried balloons and glow sticks and signs that said, "Accept everyone," and "We're all Sasha." "Get well," the sign said. "We hecka love you, Sasha." The second letter. November 11th, 2013. Dear Mr. Blank. It's me again, Richard. I just wanted to say that I'm still very sorry and I hope you're getting better. I had a nightmare last night and I woke up sweating and apologizing. I really hope you get back to the way you were. I went to court yesterday, and they're still making me seem like a monster, but I'm not. I'm a good kid if you get to know me. I'm sure you would have been a nice person, too. I regret what I did. I didn't know that your clothing would catch like it did, even though I had no reason to do it anyways. I don't know what was going through my head. I've committed a stupid act of violence, and I'm going to be punished for that. And I accept all consequences that I receive because you didn't deserve this. I didn't even know you, and I still don't. I was hoping that I can meet you face to face so I can apologize to you. I'm being charged with great bodily injury and a hate crime. I accept the first charge, but the hate crime is wrong. I don't have a problem with homosexuals. I have friends that's homosexuals, and we never had problems. So I don't look at you wrong because of your sexuality. Honestly, I could care less if you like men. You wasn't trying to talk to me in that way. I just hope that you forgive me for the pain I brought you and your family. I am not a thug, gangster, hoodlum, nor monster. I'm a young African-American male who's made a terrible mistake. Not only did I hurt you, but I hurt your family and friends, and also my family and friends, for I have brought shame to them and our country, and I shall be punished, which is going to be hard for me, because I'm not made to be incarcerated. In the Bible, Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5, it says, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, and before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nations." Consecrated means to dedicate somebody or something to a particular purpose. I'm not saying I'm a prophet. What I'm saying is God knew us before we were anything, and he made a plan for us all. And we know it's not evil, because God isn't evil, so we wasn't made to do bad things. I really don't know why I did what I did, but I hope you don't think I'm evil. I'm actually good. I've also been hurt a lot for no reason. Not like I hurt you. But I've been hurt physically and mentally, so I know how it feels. The pain and confusion of why me. I felt it before plenty of times, so I know how it feels. So get better, and I'm looking forward to meeting you so I can apologize. I'm going to write you at least 2 letters a week, so be expecting them. Also, I'll keep you in my prayers. Get well. Signed, Richard. Let's all take care of each other. Richard didn't end up writing more letters, but on November 11th, Carl wrote a letter of his own. It was sent to the parents and staff at Sequoia Elementary School, where he taught kindergarten. I think it's really important to keep in mind that none of us can know the mind, motivations, or intentions of the person who set flame to Sasha's clothing, he wrote. Oakland police have a 16-year-old high school student in custody based on video camera footage from the bus. As far as I know, police are the only people who have viewed the footage. I certainly haven't, so I can only guess at what happened. At this point, I choose to assume that this kid was playing with fire and that he gravely underestimated the consequences of that. Others may make different assumptions, but it's important to remember that they are all just that, assumptions. So when I talk to my students about this, I will emphasize the importance of fire safety. Don't play with matches or lighters. And of course, stop, drop, and roll if your clothing catches fire. He also offered language for explaining Sasha's gender identity. Being agender simply means that the person doesn't feel they are either a boy or a girl. I realize this is a concept that even adults have difficulty wrapping their heads around. My wife and I frequently slip up in our pronoun usage, much to Sasha's chagrin. So I can't pretend that it's an issue that all young children will grasp. But what they certainly can and should understand is that different people like different things. Different people dress or behave or look differently, and that's a good thing. Sasha feels comfortable wearing a skirt. It's part of their style. They also frequently sport a necktie and vest. Sasha likes the look, and frankly, so do I. It makes me smile to see Sasha being Sasha. As I wrote above, none of us can know the mind of the kid who lit a flame to Sasha's skirt. But I have a feeling that if he had seen Sasha's skirt as an expression of another kid's unique, beautiful self, and had smiled and thought, "I hella love Oakland," I wouldn't be writing this now. Again, many thanks for all of your love and kindness. Let's all take care of each other. Carl. Homophobic. Richard's extended family showed up for his second court appearance on November 15th, including Jasmine's cousin Regis, who is gay. Tall, attractive, and androgynous, Regis didn't talk to the press, but his presence was a statement in itself. I'm here, I'm queer, and I support my cousin. Inside the courtroom, reporters discussed the best terms to use when describing Sasha. Gender fluid, gender queer, gender nonconforming, agender. I just say he was wearing a skirt, one reporter offered. He gave a weary shrug. The terms change all the time. Nothing much happened in court, other than Du Bois announcing his plans to file a motion contesting the decision to try Richard as an adult. Afterward, he took questions from reporters. I've met the minor, and I can tell you he's not homophobic, not even remotely, he said. First of all, he doesn't know how to spell homophobic, much less be it. Everyone had their own theory as to why Richard had used the term. Du Bois said when he asked Richard for a definition, Richard had said that it meant he wasn't gay, that he liked girls. Jasmine said that she thought he was trying to get out of trouble by saying what he thought the police wanted him to say. But whatever his reason for saying it, it was part of the story now. Newscasters mentioned it almost every time they reported a new development. This is not a whodunit, Du Bois said. This is not even a what happened. This is what frame of mind the kid had. The attorney tended to talk about the case with a mixture of calm and exasperation, as if his powers of incredulity had already been strained to the point of breaking. He argued that the views Richard expressed in the police interview were nothing more sinister than a kid being weirded out by the sight of a boy in a skirt. They're putting him in the category of skinhead because he admitted to being homophobic, to being very homophobic, and they're saying, we take that as true. He bugged out his eyes and dropped his jaw to indicate how absurd this was. Lynchings. They're hate crimes, he said. But the kid who thinks that wearing a skirt is anomalous and decides to play a prank is not committing a hate crime. What they sent. On Sasha's first full day in the hospital, a stranger dropped off a bouquet of silk flowers, 3 white roses and 4 stalks of orange Chinese lanterns. A former burn victim herself, she knew that real flowers aren't allowed in the burn ward because of the risk of infection. That was the beginning. Within days, letters and packages began arriving at the hospital, at Maybeck High School, at Debbie and Carl's home. An online medical fund set up by Sasha's cousin raised more than $31,000 in donations. What did I get today? Sasha asked each afternoon when Debbie and Carl arrived at the hospital with the day's mail. The answer was sometimes surprising. Strangers sent money in small bills, paper cranes, a soft blanket, Star Wars stickers, a drawing of a TARDIS from Doctor Who, a 4-page play written in Spanish, a book of poems by E.E. Cummings. A friend from the live-action role-playing community sewed Sasha a skirt and matching vest. The East Bay Heritage Quilters sent a vibrant purple quilt. People from the Conlang community sent letters in their invented languages using beautiful calligraphy. People from Canada sent things with maple leaves on them. High school gay-straight alliances from all over the country sent cards decorated with rainbows. The missives piled up. Handmade cards, store-bought cards, folded sheets of notebook paper, emails. They came from Colombia, Germany, France, Australia. Get well, they said. Stay strong. Be proud. You are beautiful the way you are. Sasha couldn't concentrate on any of it for long, but they liked knowing that so many people cared. Cards from Sasha's friends stayed in the hospital room. So did the bouquet of silk flowers. Everything else, Debbie and Carl took home. Over the next few weeks, Debbie would periodically type Sasha's name into Google to see how the story was being covered around the world. Once, the search led her to a neo-Nazi site. They were having a really hard time, she said. An African-American? Oh, evil. But then it's this trans kid wearing a skirt. What? They couldn't figure out who to root against, Carl explained. He grinned. It was a really hard time for the neo-Nazi community. No hate. Nobody who knew him could believe it. Richard was a goofball, sure, but hateful. It just didn't make sense. It blew me back, Carlita Collins, the school security officer, said. It blew my weave back to the fat part. Word was that Richard had set the skirt alight at the urging of another kid, got played, fell for the okey-doke. I just couldn't understand why he would make such a childish mistake, Collins said. But then I thought about it, like, oh, he's 16. But that wasn't how the rest of the school saw it. Richard had only been there 2 months, and he didn't know too many people. For most students, all that mattered was that Ojai was in the news again, and not for any of the good things that happened there. It was like nobody ever paid attention until somebody screwed up. He was black, and he did that. Most of us that go here are black. We're expected to do something wrong, explains Emarie, who played on the football and baseball teams. People act like if you go to Ojai, that's the baddest school in Oakland. Since that happened, people just thought that all of us are basically the same. It was important to say no, to say that's not us. What our student allegedly did to Sasha is hideous and is not representative of the values we know to be true of the Oakland High community, Principal Matin Abdelkawi said in a letter he read over the school loudspeaker. We are all capable of doing what is right, even and especially when it seems impossible. We all have a responsibility to stop acts of violence. The student body at Oakland High is extremely diverse. Our families come from all over the world. Wouldn't it be amazing if we led by example and showed Oakland what it means to respect and appreciate each other's differences? A movement sprouted on campus. No H8. No hate. Students and staff painted banners that said, "Sasha, we stand with you." A student-led fundraiser collected more than $800 for Sasha's medical bills. Students folded a long chain of paper cranes and sent it to Sasha. In December, Ojai's Wildcats basketball team played its first home game wearing blue jerseys with Sasha's name on the back and the words, "No Hate," on the front. The gymnasium was festooned with handmade posters in the blue and white Wildcat colors that said, "Not in our school," and "Stand up to hate." A number of the boys on the basketball team knew Richard, and they had come to practice after his arrest, talking about what happened. Richard wasn't a bad kid, they said, just a follower. It seemed wrong that he might be locked up for life. But then one of the players pointed out that they should be thinking about the victim, too. What happened to Sasha was horrible. "That shouldn't happen to anybody," he said. "What if that had happened to somebody in your family?" That was when the team decided to order jerseys that stood up for Sasha. "We're against hate and bullying," basketball coach Orlando Watkins said when the team gathered in the locker room before the game wearing their "No Hate" jerseys. "This is a big game for us today, not just because we need the victory, but it represents something bigger than just basketball. So let's go out there today, let's play hard, let's stay focused, and let's take care of business." The team listened somberly, then gathered in a circle. "No hate on me, no hate on three," team captain Keith called. "One, two, three, no hate!" Y'all don't know. Caprice found it hard to go to school. In her time in the Oakland schools, she'd seen plenty of kids drop out or get kicked out, get shot, or get pregnant. But Richard was supposed to be different. I can't even hardly express the feelings I have, because I knew where he was trying to go, she says. I knew he would be the one graduating from here. The "No Hate" banners were everywhere, but no one was talking about Richard. Abdelkawi, the school principal, had concluded the letter he read over the loudspeaker by reminding students to show our student, currently in custody, compassion and tolerance. But Richard's friends felt that this last bit had gotten plastered over by the reams of "No Hate" posters. One by one, they showed up in Caprice's office to complain. They said it was a hate crime, but he had family that wasn't straight, Richard's friend Lydell said. "We were with No Hate, but in Richard's case, it wasn't hate. What he did was wrong, as like a joke, playful. It was like a funny little prank joke turns to something that ends your whole life." To Lydell, it just seemed like the outside world didn't grasp how easy it was for kids who grew up in poor neighborhoods to take that wrong turn. "People have different habitats," he explained. "Some people have it better than others. They grew up in good neighborhoods. Their family has jobs. They have good income. They don't understand. Their life is so good, they think everybody's life is good. They don't understand the struggles people go through. I don't know where you grew up at, if it's like a low-income area where there's a lot of violence and crime, but if you grew up in a low-income area and all you see is crime and drugs, if you have family that does crime, you see it. It has an impact on you. If you're around it a lot, it's hard to do good." "It just hurt," Cherie said. "Somebody you were that close to, and it becomes like all viral?" She shook her head. "People would say all type of stuff, like he was just intentionally trying to burn him. Like, 'Oh yeah, he gay, he hecka gay, let's burn him.' I'm not saying what he did was right. I'm just saying at the end of the day, he was 16. You're all just trying to put an opinion on something that you don't know. Y'all don't know. The Circle. Each day that the no-hate organizing at Oakland High School went on, Richard's friends grew increasingly upset. Finally, Caprice went to Principal Abdelkawi to ask if she could hold a restorative justice circle so that Richard's friends could share their feelings. She invited Amy Wilder, an Oakland High School resource specialist who was the faculty advisor for the school's Gay-Straight Alliance. Wilder, who majored in gender studies in college, had been working with students to show support for Sasha. About a dozen students gathered in a circle in an empty classroom a few days later. Most of them didn't really know each other. Richard was the one thing they had in common. The facilitator passed around a green race car that served as a talking piece. When the race car reached you, it was your turn to speak. Otherwise, you listened. The first few times the race car went around the circle, the questions were playful. If you were a superhero, what would your superpower be? Questions that let them get to know one another a bit. Then they talked about Richard. How silly he was, and how kind, and how he'd had a friend and a family member who were gay. One of them passed around a photo of Richard on a cell phone. When the phone reached Wilder, she gave a start of recognition. It was Richard's eyes she remembered, his hazel eyes. Earlier in the year, a parent had come in to meet with her and had brought along a younger sibling. The kid was wild, out of control. No way were they going to be able to have a conversation with this kid bouncing off the walls. But then Richard had come out of Caprice's office. He went over to the kid and somehow calmed him down, got him focused so the meeting could take place. Now, as she stared at Richard's picture, Wilder's eyes filled with tears. "Because he was so sweet," she explained, "and he's such a young person facing such serious consequences." When she shared that, it was huge, Caprice said afterward. "It was incredible. We could hardly take it." All they had wanted was someone else to understand. Skinned. 5 days after the second surgery, Sasha returned to the operating room, where Dr. Grossman's team used a tool called a dermatome to harvest 3-inch-wide strips of skin from Sasha's back. After removing each strip, Dr. Grossman passed it through a meshing device that perforated it with tiny holes so that it could be stretched to cover a larger area. Then he placed it over Sasha's wounds and stapled it into place. Peel, mesh, place, staple. Peel, mesh, place, staple. When it was over, the burn sites were covered with new skin. But Sasha's back was raw, exposed. The pain was intense. More intense than the burns had been. It was as if they had been skinned alive. God is good. The ladies seemed to materialize out of nowhere. There were three of them at the third court hearing on November 22nd, older white women who dressed as chastely as nuns in turtlenecks and blazers and sensible shoes. They came, they said, because they were concerned about Richard. "Not that it's not a horrible crime," one explained, "but it's also a crime to try a child as an adult." Inside the courtroom, defendants appeared in a small box to the left of the judge. It was possible to see them only if you sat on the far right side of the gallery and pressed your cheek against the wall. By the third hearing, the reporters had figured this out, and they all squished into the same column of seats, leaning into one another to get a glimpse of Richard's face. Jasmine wore glossy pink lipstick, black leggings, and a T-shirt that said Los Angeles. Her face was bright, eager, confident. She knew it would all turn out okay. "God is good," she repeated to herself in the elevator. "God is good. God is so good." "You look nice," her cousin Regis said as the family gathered in the hallway, waiting for Du Bois to be done talking to reporters. I like your hair. His own hair was gorgeous, streaked red and gold, with hair extensions he'd made himself. He was dressed stylishly in a gold jacket, tight jeans, a scarf, and lace-up boots. They were an attractive trio, he and Jasmine and Jasmine's sister Juliet. As they waited for Richard's lawyer to give them an update, they talked about what they were cooking for Thanksgiving just 2 days away. Macaroni and cheese, yams, that spinach dip they loved. Conversation turned to a case that was in the news. Donald Williams Jr., an African-American freshman at San Jose State University, had been relentlessly bullied by the white students he lived with in a four-bedroom dormitory suite. The white kids, also freshmen, had insisted on calling Williams three-fifths, a reference to the clause in the original U.S. Constitution that counted slaves as three-fifths of a person when determining population for representation in Congress. They clamped a bike lock around his neck and claimed to have lost the key. They wrote nigger on a whiteboard and draped a Confederate flag over a cardboard cutout of Elvis Presley in the suite's living room. They locked him in his room, and they claimed it was all just a series of good-natured pranks. In the end, three 18-year-old white students were expelled for what they did to Williams, and a 17-year-old was suspended. The three who were expelled were also charged in criminal court. The charge, misdemeanor battery with a hate crime enhancement, which carried a maximum penalty of a year and a half in county jail. A jury eventually convicted all three of battery, but acquitted one of the students of the hate crime charge and deadlocked on the others. Girl, they got misdemeanors, Regis said. Nobody got charged with any felonies. Three white boys on one black boy. Does it have to be me? Sasha was released from the hospital the next day, 23 days after the fire. Reporters lined the street in front of Sasha's house, pushing up against the front door. News helicopters circled. Sasha gave an interview to the local news, wearing a skirt over bandaged legs. I was really excited that an agender person was in the news, they said later, but I wasn't that excited about the circumstances, obviously. Those were my feelings. This is really great, but does it have to be me? Sasha also suspected that not everyone understood what the story was all about. I got the idea that it wasn't really about me being agender, they said. A lot of the news coverage was a boy was wearing a skirt, rather than an agender person was wearing a skirt. And that kind of bugged me, that I was being misrepresented in that way. Back at Maybeck. Sasha returned to school in December, on the Monday after the Thanksgiving break. They were eager to be back after the long, boring days in the hospital, and they dressed a little smarter than usual, matching the flat cap and skirt with a vest, bow tie, and crisp white shirt. The press was there, of course, craning to get a view of Sasha, like paparazzi angling for a shot of the royal family. Sasha's friends made a point of not making a big deal about Sasha's return, and they asked their classmates to do the same. They knew Sasha hated being the center of attention, so after greeting them with hugs, they tried to be chill. As chill as you can be with a line of news trucks idling in front of your school, antennas stabbing the sky. There were so many cameras at the school, and they were like, "Are you Sasha's friend? Can we talk to you?" Taya remembered. And that was a little weird because I didn't know how to approach my friendship with Sasha. I don't think Sasha wanted to be around their friends with their friends thinking I'm talking to a famous person or I'm talking to somebody that something horrible happened to. They just wanted things to be normal. It really distanced me from the friendship, which is a shame. After school, Sasha went to ballroom dance club. Taya was crazy about ballroom dancing, so she had started the club, and Sasha, Nemo, and Michael had joined. Sasha and Nemo were useful additions because they could dance either the male or the female part, depending on what was needed. That first day back, Sasha waltzed with Michael as their partner. Michael noticed that his friend was quieter than they'd been before, a little more inward. But overall, Sasha seemed okay. Worst days ever. There were a lot more of them now. Worst days, worst nights. The days their legs itched from the graft, from their leg hairs getting caught in the bandages, a prickly irritation that never stopped. The days their legs ached, when everything that used to be normal was suddenly difficult. Showering, seated now, using a handheld shower. Getting dressed, both legs had to be wrapped in 3 layers of bandages. Going to school, they were so tired, just so very tired. The nights after getting home from the hospital when they felt like they had to pee all the time, but couldn't, a side effect of having had a urinary catheter in for all those weeks in the hospital. The nights when sleep felt like a distant cousin they'd met long ago, but didn't know well enough to talk to. The nights they took Percocet for the pain, and it made them hyper instead of sleepy. They tried not to think about the fire or the person who said it, but sometimes it was hard not to wonder why, not to just feel incredulous that this was the situation. 1 minute you're on your way home from school, and then it's an ambulance and a hospital and surgery and pain and painkillers and bandages and seated showers. It was just like, how is this a thing that happens? Reunion. Dan Gale sat in a wicker chair in Sasha's living room beside his cousin Russell, taking deep, nervous breaths and exhaling through his teeth. It was a Saturday in early December, and Dan had been invited to join Sasha's family for brunch. Russell came along for support. The past few weeks had been a whirlwind for Dan. A month ago, he'd been an ordinary guy, a construction worker who did some extra work on the side at a friend's t-shirt shop. Then he'd taken the bus home from work one day and helped save the life of a teenager whose skirt was on fire. Suddenly he was a hero, a good Samaritan. He'd been honored at City Hall, featured on the news. Police Chief Sean Wendt had said that Dan's actions on the bus had proved that despite Oakland's reputation for crime, there are good people all over the city. Even his own family looked at him with a newfound respect. Now Dan was about to see Sasha for the first time since that day on the bus. But it was taking Sasha a while to come out of their bedroom. "They have to put these stockings on over the scars," Debbie explained. "There are a few spots that still have to be bandaged, but they're healing really well." "That's great," Dan said, his expression grave. He was in his early 50s and had Basset Hound brown eyes, a thick salt-and-pepper mustache, and a deep, gravelly voice. He crossed and uncrossed his legs, resting one of his white tennis shoes on his knee. Beside him, Russell, who owned the construction company where Dan worked, blinked sleepily, a 3-day beard peppering his cheeks. The two of them surveyed the living room, which was cozy and cluttered, its surfaces covered with houseplants, magazines, dried flowers, and framed photographs, its shelves overflowing with hardback books and board games, its limited floor space crammed with musical instruments, a piano, 2 guitars, a bongo drum, a paper banner inscribed with get well wishes wrapped nearly all the way around the room, a souvenir from the march along the 57 bus route the previous month. At last, Sasha came in, wearing a gray hoodie and a black skirt, legs swaddled in white bandages. Dan sucked in a breath. "Oh, wow," he whispered. He stood and enveloped Sasha in a hug. "How you doing, man?"
"I'm doing good."
Sasha blinked a few times, grinning shyly.
"You look great."
"Yeah, I'm not feeling too bad."
"That's great. Don't change who you are, dude. Don't change."
Dan shook his head.
"This is weird.
Awkward."
His eyes brimmed with tears.
I'm sorry, dude. I'm really sorry, he croaked, voice breaking.
Thanks for all you did, Carl said, coming into the room behind Sasha.
Man, I'm sorry I couldn't have done more.
Dan turned to Sasha.
It was hard to get to you.
You did all you could, Sasha said. You did the best.
But Dan had already moved on to the future. He wanted to accompany Sasha on their return to the